Hello and welcome back to the Research VR Podcast, everyone. The podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today are two of the wonderful people from Leap Motion, Martin Schubert and Barrett Fox. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Oz. How's it going?
Super happy to have you guys back. And Martin, this is your second time on the podcast, so this is kind of cool that we're at that stage now that we can have returning guests. It's almost like two and a half years of this podcast, so exciting times. A lot has happened since we have last talked. Oh, sorry, Peter. I'm sorry. I forgot to introduce you. And our co-host, Peter Leckoff, hosting in from Germany.
Hello. Hello.
So, guys, why don't I let you kind of introduce the concept that we're here to talk about today and describe a little bit of what's going on at Leap Motion with these design sprints.
So, since the last time we talked, Barrett and I have been pretty hard at work on a series of interaction design sprints where we've basically tried to identify an area of hands in virtual reality, an area of design that we feel is like important and pretty atomic and fundamental and that hasn't been explored. And we define that area and then come up with three or four different sort of experimental solutions to try to solve how would we do this with hands in virtual reality.
We're trying to pick questions and granular areas of interaction that would be relative to both VR and AR going forward. And we're trying to be very experimental, be very iterative, rapidly prototype, stand up things as quick as we can, and get as many answers teased out from that first iteration as we can, rinse and repeat a few times, and share the results.
Cool. And before Wonderful. We jump into the specifics of what you guys have made, how are you picking these subjects and things to tackle? Because I mean, I notice, you know, typing isn't one of them, so I'm guessing that's not that it hasn't been thought of or you guys haven't tried, but how do you pick these problems that to solve in VR and AR?
So I think at the start we were pretty close to sort of what we already had. We have the interaction engine, which allows grabbing, releasing really nicely, and then we have a set of buttons and sliders that are based on the interaction engine, interaction buttons and sliders that are physically depressible, movable, all that sort of stuff. And then sort of after that, we looked at, okay, well, what are large areas specific to hands that haven't had that much exploration yet? So for the first one, it was, well, your virtual hands are going to go through objects. And that's sort of an inevitable part of the way that the interaction engine is built and the way that virtual objects and real hands collide. So let's look at that area. And then the next one was sort of, okay, we can grab individual things that are close to us, but what about things that are further away than that? So it's sort of, rather than looking at like one area like typing maybe and trying to make typing work with hands, I think we come more from, okay, here are the things that are unique and are strengths of hands as an input, and how can we then, building on that base, look at other areas that we can't yet do as well as we can pick things up naturally? How can we build off of what we already have?
For example, the scaffolding interaction sprint that we did came out of some discussions with some external partners and developers, and we have this interaction engine, which is a pretty rich heuristic that our engineers created for grasping. It is a pretty strong bit of physics where your hands start colliding and start popping apart the objects that you're trying to grasp. We do a handoff to a bit of our physics extension. And the combination of that rich heuristic for grasping and that kind of tricky handoff to physics in real time makes for pretty decent grasping. And we can drag a Unity mono behavior onto an object and make it graspable in 5 seconds. But these external partners said, like, okay, that's cool. You can stack things and you can grasp them and put them on top of each other, but it's messy. They tumble around and they're hard to align. How would you do things more accurately? How could you stack with intentionality? And so the scaffolding kind of came out of responding to their questions. Let's explore that. Let's explore placing and stacking things with a little precision And the scaffolding grid came out of that.
So when you are planning your sprints and your demos and also your experiments, how much do you rely on external partners? Because I was just on the IEEE EVR, and there were a lot of talks and a lot of paper sessions that have been involving, in one way or another, the LeapMotion. And it was kind of very eye-opening to me that not only I am very much aware of this device, but it basically seems to be nearly the standard for, you know, finger tracking, at least in the scientific community. And also there were some papers presented where they were researching how to grab objects. They were comparing your algorithms to theirs, the friction between fingers, objects, whatever. So it is like not only you are building those awesome experiments, but it seems like science is also highly interested in that. Do you get any inspiration from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we whenever there's interesting things that people are doing with LeapMotion, they're sent around internal Slacks, and we're looking at GIFs and on Twitter. But I think we're in a really like privileged position here to be able to focus on this stuff in a full-time capacity. I think a lot of people in the scientific community are, you know, trying to answer a question, or people in the game development community might be integrating Leap on top of having controller support, because that's a content that's a market right now. So in having this nice ability to really focus on one area, I think that's maybe why we've gotten to get these things out so quickly and do such deep dives, is because we're just focused on how do we take this stuff, and also we have the people who've made the interaction engine are sitting down the row from us, so we can go and talk to them and integrate things well. I think it's just a really hard problem to try to get real hands interacting with virtual objects in a way that anybody can put on a headset and start using them. And hopefully, the idea with our interaction sprints is so that we get these experiments out, and hopefully it gets people thinking about, okay, well, wow, I didn't know LeapMotion could be used to reliably stack and build objects, physics-based objects. Now maybe I can think about this other application that I didn't think about before.
Right. I think the importance of this, of what you guys are doing with these interaction spins, with having, you know, two people or however many people you have dedicated to being able to solve these problems, is it's very important. And I've only seen it done at least publicly one other time, and that was the Google Daydream design team back in like 2016. You know, they had a seven-week design sprint where every week they had to do something new, and then they had presented a whole talk at Google I/O. And I think, from what I understand by just looking at the results of what they talked about with the social interaction design problems that they were solving, to what came in Rec Room just a month or two after that, I saw a lot of inspiration coming from that talk, and I can see a similar amount of influence that these articles, these blog posts that you guys are actually writing, having on future products. Both, I mean, you guys are using virtual reality, but I really think augmented reality will have a huge impact with some of these grasping and touching and interacting problems that you're solving. Before we jump into all of these, I actually want to make a quick shout to trying out this Ultra Haptics device last week using a LeapMotion. This is something that we've talked about, but I just haven't had a chance to try it up until GDC. And I forgot to talk about this in the last episode, Peter. But this Ultra Haptics is a board. It kind of looks like a small keyboard that has lots of little dimples on it. And it's some kind of like deep beam forming ultrasonic waves that are being projected towards your fingers, and you could feel very lightly the things that you're touching in VR. And that paired with LeapMotion, you have like, you know, perfect hand tracking and a little bit of real tactile feedback. And I think even if it's so little, like you don't feel the edges that hard, but like some haptics are better than none. And I guess, was that something that you guys have tried as well, or do you see some kind of future where we have real haptics that come back with fingers?
We talk to the Ultra Haptics folks and kind of share our examples of the types of interactions that work well with the state of Leap, and share our quite a few man years of people years of exploring interactions, and we share that stuff with Ultra Haptics. We're fans of what they're doing. It's pretty cool. one of the things that we've discovered as we start to really dive down into the details of the visual affordances, as we create a button, we've been through like 10 iterations of the rewriting the physics of a button, rewriting the logic and the state machine of a button.
Sure.
Then reskinning of the buttons. And we've been through many, many rinses and repeats on just that one thing. One of the things that's bubbled up out of that is there's been a few demo projects and a few experiments where we've had the chance to like really drill down on the affordances. How far does it push? Maybe there's an accordion. Maybe there's a little runway to guide your finger into it in 3D perspective. How does it flash? What is the sound it makes? And go into detail. Martin's done a fair amount of this in that sculpture demo that he and I worked on. But when we went hyper granular on a few button passes, we actually got people saying, I think I felt that. Around the 20th person that volunteers that information, I won't call it a great sample size, but around the 20th time somebody says, I think I felt that, I do believe there is some notion of faux haptics or faptics that that could bubble out of VR work. And we don't know what it is that really nails that in the user. But to circle back to the ultra haptics, I agree with you that even some haptics can be very, very powerful. And I think that there's a huge gradient of like from no haptics to super haptics. And there's plenty of exploration to do in there.
Yeah, I agree definitely that there's this overlap of like not actually having physical haptics and being able to make up for a ton of it through audiovisual, like overloading audiovisual with things that you otherwise wouldn't get. So the hand contact interaction sprint was basically all about that. It was if your hands are going to intersect virtual geometry, static geometry, or objects when you grab them, that your fingers go through them. If we focus a bit of design on those intersections, you can make people feel, and a bit of audio. So if you put your hand through a table, you can see an outline around your fingers and you hear a buzzing that's dependent on, you know, how far down your fingers are. You can get your brain to be like, well, I'm touching something, even though I'm not. And that's, you know, you can take a large amount of the pseudo haptics, if you want to call it, or haptics, and that can be pretty good. And then I think we're going to see all of these other solutions from ultra haptics to, there's another company called GoTouch. I think they just called GoTouch now. They might have been called GoTouch VR, who are creating basically a fingertip clip that displaces the skin on your fingertip when they're using muscle tracking. And that was really, really convincing. That was maybe one of the most convincing ones I've ever tried. These guys were researchers and have just finished a lot of research on the skin displacement and that being an actual one of the ways that
I actually tried it on the IEEE, I think they were there. It felt very interesting. You were basically able to feel the variation in the surface of the sphere, right? That's what you're discussing, where you actually touch it with your finger, it kind of sticks to it and then wobbles around for some time.
Yeah. I think that sort of, and there's another for the Vive controllers, there's a company called Tactical Haptics, which is doing a similar thing with skin displacement in the hand. I think we're going to see a lot of these different approaches, but all of them, I think, are going to be something that is sort of use case dependent. If you have the space to put ultrasonic transducers on the wall and have them pulse sound at you, or you have the space to clip things on your hands, I think there's going to be tons of options for that. But I think for the mass mainstream adoption of this stuff, putting on one device, starting to interact, and then having a lot of it be done through design is where it's...
And I mean, you can go further. And I mean, obviously, the Leap Motion used to be a desktop device, but when we go into your current prototype, the mobile one, you kind of don't want to sit in your room anyway with that, right? You kind of want to be on the go, particularly when we go into the direction of augmented reality, always to have it with you, so they won't be like those ultrasonic blasters around you anyway.
I'm gonna keep harping at this vision until it becomes a thing in people's heads that this should be pursued. My grand idea of augmented reality actually doesn't even go outside into the real world, which I think we can do, you know, especially in cars and whatnot, like when you can use the whole dashboard. But my ideal sense of augmented reality would be on a desk where I can sit here the same way that you sit in front of a computer. Yes. Perhaps you might even have a mouse and keyboard, but rather than having monitors, we have a holographic projector and you can, mm-hmm. you know, you still do the same kind of spatial computing things. And you could still use your fingers. I think hand interactions will definitely be a big thing at that point. It will be a combination of like perhaps mouse and keyboard and hand and perhaps even eye tracking UI. I don't know. I keep talking about this almost every episode now, but I think honestly, with something like Ultra Haptics, it might make sense if you have a seated desk sort of workstation and you want to be able to kind of like manipulate things in space.
Like you're saying, the use case of like if you have a table, if you're, and especially if you're doing something that's enterprise, industrial, medical, anything that you need high precision for, I kind of make the split difference between like casual use of computers now, of you know your iPhone, your iPad, your tablet, your smartphone versus your desktop PC. And I think there's going to be a split sort of with inputs too, in that you'll have casual inputs and then you'll layer on more intense inputs that require you in a certain position for what you're doing.
Absolutely.
I guess similarly to now PCs, you know, you have joysticks for flying games or Wacom tablets for artists. I think it could still be modular in that sense.
Thing there, Oz, that's very near and dear. And before I joined Leap, I was working at my desk for 20 years. And I, month before I joined Leap, I was in my living room talking to my wife and I'm saying like, really, I'm ready to get away from the monitor and the desk permanently. And I'm ready to start like computing with my body. And I met Leap folks a month later and I said, really sign me up. So flash forward to 3.5 years later and Martin and I, our desks are next to each other. But we have, you know, a 15 by 15 space around each of our desks. And I use mine constantly every day and am rapidly getting into that mode that I was hoping to be in, where I'm using pretty big gestures sometimes and smaller gestures. But I really am starting to kind of know that 3 years future. 3 years ahead future of being able to be expressive, being able to reach for things. And that whole embodied cognition thing is starting to have a lot of depth to it now, where, you know, I'm starting to think that I may put one piece of work to the side of me, and I may put these batch of photos behind my shoulder, and I may start to put this other work here. And in AR, I'll start having specific areas of work on my desk. And so that ability to like really start to get the most out of embodied cognition, I see starting to happen.
What I find fascinating is that you're one of the not many startups out there. I mean, let's don't count Microsoft and Google. They have really a lot of resources, but you're one of those startups that actually talks about affordances, about embodied cognition. You have scientists on the team and your blog articles basically show that you put a lot of thought and kind of try to deeply understand the topics as much as you can, which I think is fundamentally something that I always liked about Leap Motion. It's a very great attitude.
I've worked in VR adjacent technology for 20 years, you know, some form of 3D interaction for a long time. And to me, this slice of time feels just as early as all the other times. There's so much complexity in this new medium that there's an enormous amount to be explored. So just doing some humble, iterative, granular exploration is something that the industry needs in high volume. We do need more people saying, hey, I will pick a lane and explore a little piece of this and share my results, versus too much manifestoing and saying, like, we already have the new rules of VR interaction.
That's fair. The approach is you're saying should be a little bit different in terms of this is what I've learned from my things rather than these are the rules that I'm now planting my flag over. That's a great segue into talking a little bit about you talking about embodied cognition and about being able to embody things that are not from, you know, our limbs or perhaps connected to our limbs. Everything about Leap Motion starts with your hands. And I guess one of the first problems you tried to tackle was the problem that there isn't anything that's holding your hand from going through a desk. And how do you communicate that visually? Let's start from the top and we'll kind of go through these design sprints as you guys started them. And we'll talk a little bit about what you built. This is, and for our listeners, this is a highly visual podcast, I'll say. So I'll have the links for these articles that have beautiful amount of GIFs in them in the show link. So you can follow along. Everything is going to be time coded as well. If we reference an article, it'll be there. So yeah, let's start with the first sprint, guys.
Yeah.
What did you take through?
Buttons and sculptures, or hands going through stuff?
I guess the hand going through the balls and spheres.
That one was focused on hand contact. So as you're saying, basically we realized, you know, your hands are moving in the real world. When you're interacting with virtual objects, nothing's going to stop them. So naturally, your hands are going to be going through virtual geometry. And at the time, we hadn't really seen much for acknowledging that or even possibly using it as a way of giving the user more information. So we came up with a couple of different experiments. The first one was basically just like the lowest common thing. Your hand goes through something, put an outline around the fingers, show the user that, one, the system knows that your hand is going through things, and also show it a little bit like a fade so you can see that your fingers still exist, because it's kind of disconcerting to see your fingers sort of cut off in the virtual scene, especially if they're trying to get you to embody these hands, to then see them go through, you know, seemingly solid objects is kind of strange. So the first one was basically just an intersection outline shader and worked pretty nicely, I think. I've been trying to put that on everything that we've built since then, because I think it, as a baseline, should be there. Then after that, the second one was sort of looking at, okay, well, we can acknowledge that your hand is going through an object. What if we, as well, could give the user a bit more information about how far their fingers are from objects? Something that we found a lot when people put on a headset and they have a Leap Motion attached, everyone has a pretty good understanding of how to use their hands. They've been using their hands their entire lives. And then when you get them in VR, all of a sudden things are a little bit different. They're very similar, but they're a little bit different. And so people's depth perception might be a little bit off. They might reach for objects and grab a couple inches in front of where the object actually is. So depth perception and depth cues are really important. Things like shadows help a lot with that. And so for the second execution, we thought, well, what if we could give the user more information about how close their fingertips are to an object by making the fingertips glow the closer they are, the same color as the object? And what that ended up feeling a lot like was remapping heat is what it kind of ends up looking like. So you're remapping proximity to a visual affordance, and it helped a lot with, like, where are my fingers? How close are they? Am I touching something? Am I not? So that was another way of coming at that problem.
So a quick question to throw in there. When you're evaluating these iterations, and I'm guessing, you know, you don't have enough time to, like, set up, let's say, a scientific study, but, like, how do you go about evaluating, like, does this feel good? Is this making me more accurate? Is it something that you intuitively are recognizing or trying to test on other people in Leap Motion?
Yeah, but I mean, so these things are, we're doing these sprints trying to get them done in like 2 weeks or so. So in that time frame, first couple of days are, we have a long list of like different areas that we'd want to explore. But basically we're trying to pick the most fruitful and the ones that we think we could get done in that period of time as well. So we pick this hand contact area, and then we have another list of like, okay, what are the things that we could do? Scope them. How long is this actually going to take from an engineering perspective to implement? And then just try to get as many of them done as possible. And then a lot of this, and I think that's where what we found is the most useful part of this, is you just don't know until you build it. Like you make the thing, you put your hands in it, you try to touch something, and you're like, wait, this doesn't help me at all. This has made things worse. Or, wow, this is actually really useful. So as a first line, both of us trying things, and also working in a team is great, because I can prototype something real quick, show it to Barry, and he'll be like, oh, this is pretty good. And yeah, we get people in the office to come in and try things, especially at this point, it's pretty hard to find people in the office who haven't got much VR experience, but that's always the best test case. But yeah, I mean, we're moving so quick on these that it's basically get things done, make them and then see how they perform. And luckily, a lot of them have been working out pretty nicely.
Got it. But you don't have a standardized test or anything that you're trying to complete, like a certain task?
We'd love to do more user testing. We did a ton of user testing for the interaction engine itself for graph and releasing, because that's such a like atomic fundamental part. But because these are really experimental, we're just, you know, trying to see what they result in.
We built out a full test suite to measure the grabbing affordances and export JSON for our people to analyze, and had dozens of users in. And we've done that for chunks of interactions here at Leap over the years. And we've even had small groups to test our interaction sprints kind of formally, but usually it's internal.
Sure. How much do you try to analyze the ergonomics of the grasp or capture maybe additionally from external basically depth cameras how the hand moves? Because I would imagine when you design new ways to interact with objects, particularly the ergonomics part, should be maybe also an aspect.
I think this is kind of a sideways answer to your question. One of the places where ergonomics was really clear was in our summoning exercise, and we'll talk more about this apparently, but in the summoning, we created an interaction where you would reach out full extension of your arm and use your arm as a selection mechanism for things at a distance. And while it works pretty decently, it's not something that you want to do for long periods of time, because that gesture of reaching your arm out and holding it there is obviously pretty hard. The ergonomics is a thread throughout these interaction sprints. We haven't gone super granular into the ergonomics of grasping, but Martin has done some good exploration into the affordances of grasping.
Which is, yeah, so that actually leads nicely into the third experiment on the first sprint, the hand contact sprint, which was looking at, so the first one was just your hand is going through geometry. The second one was, how can we give you more information? The third one was, how do you resolve that people grab objects in VR really weirdly and however they want? So I'd made the last time I came on the Research VR podcast, I think I just finished an extension of the weightless demo I made, where you throw, it was like a little game where you grab projectiles and throw them and then pinch and drag and you can get them to hit targets. And in that, I'd made these little projectiles, and one thing that we saw a lot with people grabbing objects using the interaction engine is that people don't have the same sort of approach that they do with real objects. With real objects, you know, you get close to the edge of the object, and then your fingers touch the perimeter, and then you don't close your hand anymore. But in VR, obviously, you don't have that moment. And so some people will get pretty close, and they'll indent their fingers slightly. Some people just close their hand entirely, and they make a fist inside like a cube, right? And that can be a little bit harder, especially when we're trying to figure out when you've released it, because then when you open your hands again, your fingers might still be in the perimeter of the object. And so it makes the heuristics that we have a little bit harder to do. So we thought maybe on the design side, let's look at affordances. Let's look at industrial design. How do we get people to grab objects in a sort of predictable way? In that demo, I'd modeled in handholds. I'd looked at like bowling balls, at baseballs, at grips, how do people hold things, and tried to model some things in there that would encourage people to grab them in the holes. Turns out nobody really did that. Like, a random amount of people would have done that, but as many people just grabbed it however they wanted. Which I ended up looking kind of strange as well, because then their hands were half in the handholds and half not in the handholds, which didn't really solve the problem. So for this third execution, I wanted to look at, rather than modeling in these static affordances, what if we made dynamic affordances that reacted however someone grabbed them, so that when your fingers go through the perimeter of the object, you know, it kind of ends up looking like a soft body thing, but it was kind of more an illusion than a real soft body thing. Soft body things are kind of expensive. But the fourth or fifth execution there was, instead of bulging where your finger goes through them, what if using some ray casts and some layer trickery, make it look as though a finger hold appears wherever your finger ends up touching the object. So these things, although they don't change the underlying physics of what's happening or the underlying code of what's happening in the interaction, from a sort of believability standpoint and sort of a just this might be a real thing that I'm holding, it makes a lot more sense when you can see, okay, yeah, I can deal with this. This is similar to what I know from the real world. So I think you can come at all these this is maybe not so much ergonomics, grabbing ergonomics. You can come at them from different sides, from the design side, from the code side. But I think we should be exploring all of these things to figure out which combination is the best.
Yeah, I love the examples with the spheres where what you were just talking about in terms of making these dimples that appear when your fingers are going through it. And the second extension of that was that you also had the discoloration of the finger along with the dimples appearing. So how does that combination work in? I mean, having more visual cues can help you understand. I guess the discoloration is better for orientation of your hand in space, and then dimples are for the orientation of your hand within the sphere.
The combination, yeah, that like fourth or fifth one in the middle there, where it was dimples plus finger gradient determined by depth of finger in the object. That one I was just like, okay, well, I have this system for the finger gradient and I have the dimples. I wonder what it would feel like to combine them, but rather than be driven by proximity, have the gradient be driven by depth. And that was very, you know, doesn't look real, but I think it's an interesting way of doing something that you can only do in VR, in that I can put my hands through objects. What if when I put my hands through objects, the objects kind of blend and meld with my hand, because that's sort of already what's happening. I think there are as many things that we can do to make the virtual interactions feel real. As much, there should be new things that we're like, well, we can only do this in VR. Maybe this becomes a VR native thing or something that, you know, lets me differentiate between real interactions and virtual interactions and builds up a new language for virtual interactions.
One of the themes that'll be recurrent as we talk about any of these sprints is that as you drill down into the interaction, new affordance ideas are popping up every time we drive into one of these interactions. And a combination of affordances is where it keeps leading us every time. And one of the things that's interesting is if you think about the affordance of hover on a web page, you put a mouse over a box and it's a binary thing. You are hovering that. Take hover, or the notion of hover, in VR, and suddenly you're in three dimensions, and you not only have a binary of what is the binary of hovering? Is it a certain distance? Is it a certain orientation above an object, to the side of it, around it? And how do you afford that hover? Does something blink, or does it glow based on how close you are? Or does it scale up based on how close you are? Or does it respond in some sort of interesting sculpture way that Martin might explore? I think that if you think of just hover as one facet, one state of an interaction, there's quite a bit of complexity in hover to explore. And there are a combination of affordances of both sound and vision and shape and silhouette and brightness and contrast and all of these things to explore with hovering. And what's interesting about it is that it gives you, hovering alone gives you this ability to explore proprioceptively where your body is in space and tell the user how close they are, which direction are they approaching it from. And it gets very, very rich, but that richness can just provide all of this specific feedback to the user about where they are in space. And if we think about the fact that, like, as you dive into today's state of VR, it kind of turns everybody into a five-year-old. There's like some sensory deprivation, there's some sensory overload and other senses at the same time. And so these types of proprioceptive scaffolds are really, really valuable to kind of give a user breadcrumb trail of like, yeah, this is going to react to you when you get near it. This is going to respond to you. It's a rich combinatory unexplored area that's really fun right now.
Maybe a side question. When you were talking previously about the ergonomics part and now about this hovering, have you ever experienced or experimented with eye tracking to support the detection of the user's intention?
And some combinatory experiments with head tracking. And I haven't used eye tracking specifically, and there's a lot of territory to explore, but head tracking to give a one step of activation to a section of UI, then combined with hand proximity to activate the rest of it, was something that we explored. Like head tracking would bring up a panel, hand presence would activate certain buttons and sliders on that panel. And I think it's a great territory to explore.
I think that's a great segue into the second design sprint, which is all about summoning things from far away, having far reaching grasp and interaction. So yeah, that's a big problem in VR, right? Is being you only have the arm's length of things that you can reach to without first either teleporting or moving the world and going there. That's a very big problem when it comes to being able to interact with more things than you can. What were your initial thoughts and impressions, or the research questions that you wanted to answer?
With the interaction engine, we can get things that are within our reach, but what happens if things are not? There is a AR scenario that will be played out infinitely starting a few months from now, which is, you know, if there's an icon on top of that skyscraper that's marking that skyscraper across town, you can't reach that. So how do you get it into your hands if you want to customize it or do something to it? And things will always be out of our reach, but virtual things we can get to us. So just that. And we started doing three experiments on how to approach that.
Yeah, so we actually had a bunch of, I think we had like four, five or six different approaches that we wanted to do. This one, in comparison to the hand contact one, was much more engineering heavy. The hand contact one wanted, you know, some shaders, some other little things. This is like, we need to make a full interaction here, which is multi-stage, and then do it a couple of times for different executions. So we tried to sort of sort them by sort of what they, how they solve the problem. So the first one was basically like the minimum viable product of summoning. You are standing in a location, you can see objects that are out of your reach, and you want to bring those objects closer. So what's the smallest amount of actions, or what's a nicely reusable set of actions that solves bringing something from there to here, and then once I have it, if I want to put it back, also be able to do that. I think this is also a good time to, just as a little quick aside, to talk about the difference between designing for hands and designing for controllers, which I gave like a 45-minute talk on called Designing for Hands, Not Controllers, because I think at the moment a lot of people who've tried Leap have tried implementations of Leap which are added on top of controller interactions or porting controller interactions to hands, and they don't end up working out that well normally. I think the main difference is with controllers, you have one point of spatial tracking that you can move around to do spatial interactions, and then you have a bunch of buttons and joysticks and trackpads and triggers, right, which can modify where you're holding something, what rotation you're holding it at, and then buttons and joysticks. With hands, you don't have any buttons and joysticks. You don't have really any reliable, super reliable binary input. You have pinching, but we don't want to overload pinch with too many things because it's just one motion.
You don't want to be a HoloLens, yeah.
Right, yeah. So and we don't just track pinches. We track your whole hands. You track your whole skeleton, which allows you to do things that are much more complicated than you could do with just pinching. But so that means that if we're thinking about, okay, I'm standing here, there's a shelf in front of me and I want to take one of the objects down here, you have to think about, with a controller, be easy. You point at the thing, and also with a controller, it's much easier to do laser pointing because it's, you know, it's tracked by Lighthouse or by whatever other system. So I can hold this object and point at something, and then I can just pull the trigger, and then it would come towards me. That's pretty simple. With hands, so to break that series of things down, pointing at something, pulling the trigger to select it, and then maybe pulling the trigger twice to then summon it, to do that set of actions with hands, the first step is selecting, right? So to select something with your hand, if you try to hold your hand up fully extended, it's very hard to keep it still. When you're holding an object, it's a little bit easier to hold that object still, but holding your hand out is pretty difficult. So if you were to try just with your index finger and using your index finger to point at something, if you've held a laser pointer, that wobbles a lot. So it's not very stable.
Right.
Do you want to talk about the projective?
Sure, yeah. One of our engineers, John Selstad, kind of figured this out when he first landed with us. You know, it's really obvious that if you're holding a battleship in the palm of your hand and it had no mass, the end of that battleship is swinging wildly just because it magnifies the rotation of your hand. But John thought of And so, you know, a lot of developers would cast a ray from the palm. John thought of casting a ray from a shoulder position through your palm, and suddenly you get a thing that has the stability of your arm. So,
because you have two pivot points, right, rather than singular.
Exactly. Yes, and that created a very stable way to select things. So raycasting there lets us kind of select at a distance, and we put colliders for detecting that ray that are a little larger than the object, and the colliders can get larger if the object is farther away, so that your hit point on that object is forgiving.
What's happening behind the scenes is you've got a line starting at your shoulder offset, going through your palm, shooting out, and then the objects, although they're quite small, depending on the distance, have a larger collider. So when the ray cast hits any part of that collider, it bends the ray into the center. So what ends up happening is you're moving it around and it's snapping to the objects, but just feels a lot easier. So that's one, is being able to select at a distance. Then the other part was also that all of these systems, we wanted them to be able to be used in conjunction with directly manipulating stuff. So I want to be able to interact with stuff here and not be accidentally raycasting all over the place. And so to gate that, we looked at, and that's one of the really great things with Leap and natural sort of input, is that you can look at metaphors from the real world. Like, if you want to reach something, what do you do? Well, kids reach out with their hand, you know, with their fingers extended and pretty far out, like if they're trying to grab something. So we thought, well, that's great, let's grab that. So if you're interacting with stuff near you, you don't raycast. If your palm is beyond a certain radius from the camera and your fingers are extended, then we raycast. So you need to meet these two conditions for the raycast to happen. So that segments direct interaction from trying to summon something. So now you've got this raycast. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, from the GIFs, I thought there was a gesture that you were also doing with your left hand to kind of like close the palm and then cast out with your right hand. No, it's not. That's just your hand.
No, that was in the second execution. So then this is like the most pedantic sort of like, do this, do that, do this. And then after that, we kind of relax the constraints to make it a bit more casual and quicker and different approach. So the first one, raycasting, then to select, you do a grab motion, which is sort of like, you know, reaching out to grab something. It selects it. And then, now you've selected it, how do you get something to come closer to you? Well, pretty universal gesture for that is having your palm raised to the sky and then curling your fingers in a, like a come here motion. And so we are checking, once you've selected something, we check, is your palm facing up? How curled are your fingers? And depending on the curl of your fingers, it animates the object to you.
You know, those checking for grab from our API and then checking for finger curl from our API. These are the kind of things that are the building blocks of our heuristics. Like the API exposes these things and it's pretty easy to write code that checks those things for a hand. What's really fun with the summoning is it animates as you curl your hand along a path. But it doesn't animate backwards, so you can just kind of like tickle it, and it will come to you. And that piece of it's pretty satisfying. Now, this is to the experimental nature of these things. Martin and I find that like the multi-step heuristic that we just described of reach, palm up, grasp, twist, curl. Is multi-step, but Martin and I were able to just like do this. We could really like do that and do it in one motion and really reliably and repeatedly. Like that satisfies that heuristic instantly. But users, we do have to tutorialize this summons gesture.
Let me explain what you just did there, that for our listeners is you did a very quick motion of like move your hand out and then snap it around and then do a come hither gesture and it flings out towards you. So it's a almost all in one step rather than a granule.
So all that long 5-minute explanation of the heuristics for finger poses, hand extended, all that stuff to do a reach out, grab, rotate your hand, and then curl your fingers. Even actually what Barrett just did was if you reach out, close your fist, and then with a closed fist, if you rotate your hand like this, now you've met the heuristics that we just described.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's like catching a fly.
So if
looking at in your hand, what's inside it.
You're right, yeah. And so I think the important thing that we discovered with this set of heuristics is that if you were to describe these abstractly, it seems very complicated. You have to do all these different hand poses, and they're very not related to any physical things. It's not like grabbing something. But because we've lent on all these physical metaphors or universal gestures isn't even the right word, really. Things that people do in the real world and they already know, if they want to reach something, they do this. People generally, children do this. Because we can lean on these known physical actions, it isn't really an abstract gesture anymore, but it's not really a direct physical interaction, but it's somewhere in between. I think that's really the sweet spot for hands in VR.
And that's where new affordances present themselves in a pretty obvious way, like that ray cast and the visual Bezier curve version of that ray cast is an affordance that lends itself, like, to tell the user what they're selecting. There's many types of novel affordances that kind of crop up logically. Well, if we're going to ask the user to do X, we need to show them Y so that they can figure that out. And so we're led by our own breadcrumb trail of affordance choices, kind of down that path. One more thing about the summoning thing is that this is made to work in conjunction with the interaction engine again. So this is one of the things, Peter, to your earlier question about researching a little more research mode and a little more detailed iteration. When that summoned object lands in your hand, we do a handoff from our experimental summoning code back to the interaction engine. And this is one time where we have a feedback loop with the interaction engine engineers to say, hey, what if instead of grasping an object, I just want to place it in my hand and register a grasp?
So yes.
This is a perfect example of them expanding their feature set and hooks into the interaction engine to say, how about if I place the object there through animation and then ask if it's grasped? And so that way we can do this seamless handoff to fly that object in your hand, and then the interaction engine object takes over in this personal space area.
Okay.
And once you reach out past that radius, you can let it go, and instead of the interaction engine dropping it, our summoning code returns it back to where it was if you drop it past the threshold of your personal space.
Yeah. So in that first execution, object on a shelf, select it, summon it, move it around, and if you hold it out past a certain radius, it returns to you. And that was another ergonomic thing of, yeah, initially we were summoning, grabbing, and then once the object came close to you, you'd have to ungrab and re-grab to grab it so the interaction engine would work. But obviously, ergonomic-wise, that doesn't make any sense. So adapt the code to make that work.
We do a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pull requests to the interaction engine repo that wind up because of these interaction sprints. It's like, it's really great for those guys to have a multiplicity of new use cases explored. So it gives them feedback like, hey, we're trying to do this with it over here, and can you support that? And it's great collaboration with those guys.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I guess this all leads to one of the bigger problems that I still deal with VR and being able to do 3D modeling in VR is the question of accuracy and precision versus, you know, ease of use. I think VR is amazing on the ease of use side, and for people like that without a real 3D modeling background to be able to go into Medium or Google Blocks, which you guys reference in this next article. It's being able to actually build something with 90 degree, you know, angles and be able to sculpt it in a way that you want to without having to deal with either physics or I don't want to ruin the whole chronological, the order of the article, because you guys really set the problem, or you take a lot of time to actually talk about the problem itself. So, Martin, yeah, why don't we talk about the scaffolding issue?
Real quick to finish up on the summoning one.
Please.
Say the last two executions very quickly. So the first one was, you've got objects on a shelf, you want to bring them closer, you want to send them back to their spot on the shelf. The second one was, what if you have a bunch of physics-enabled objects and you want to be able to summon them quicker? So we relax the constraint, palm up, this finger curl will launch objects towards you, so you can do it to a bunch of objects very quickly. But that execution was still, there are objects a set distance from me. I want to select them and then command them to come over here. The third execution, which I think was the most successful and probably the most popular out of the ones that we got to do, was the extendo hands one. And that was about, rather than selecting objects that are far away from you and commanding them to come to you, it was about extending your arms so that you could reach objects that were further away than your physical arms could reach. And I think that one's probably the most important and interesting one in terms of embodied cognition, because rather than being a command system, it was an embodied way of extending your reach through superpowers in VR.
Astral.
Actually, yeah, let's not jump over that. I'm sorry I missed that aspect. That actually is definitely, you're right, the more interesting aspect, where how do you actually extend the palm, your reach? And it seems like you're built a sphere around how far you can reach, and within that sphere it's kind of like a it's not a linear scale. The further out you reach with your hand, the I don't know what type of scale that you're using, but maybe we can try to explain this in an audit in a sound for our listeners without being able to see it.
So there are a lot of like 3D human-computer interaction, super long history, lots of approaches. This one, I found out after we prototyped it, there's a name for it, and it's called the Go-Go Hand approach. Go-Go Gadget, Inspector Gadget inspired. We made references to the Fantastic Four, Mrs. Stretch, the Green Lantern.
That's right.
But I think it's a general, pretty accepted trope of, like, you want your arms to be long, you want to be able to reach out and grab stuff. And the space that you were just talking about, in that you can do that, it ends up being this sort of projective space dependent on how far the object is. But Barrett, maybe you want to talk about the projective space problem.
This one starts with a raycast selection, just like the other one. But what you do is, when you raycast onto an object that's far away, you just throw your hand out to its surface. And there you have your interaction hand still controlled by you.
But still have your fingers, you still have all the granularity. Yep.
Yeah. Now, to get it back to you and to interact with it at that distance, you have, and I'll describe this in radio style, so I don't need a visual. You have a transform space around your personal space that is one-to-one scaled to you. That's your scale. But there is another transform space that is larger, and if you translate the hand along that larger transform space, it's going to mirror your movements, but it's going to travel farther because the transform space has been scaled up. Now, that transform space is scaled up based on how far away your hand had to reach. And that way, when your hand shoots out really far to grab something far away, then when you move it side to side, it covers a lot of distance. Then, as you bring your physical hand towards your chest, scale that transform space back down to one-to-one. So that as your hand reaches your chest again, we've transformed you back to one-to-one space, and as that happens, the object is magically in your hand.
So what that ends up meaning is that you've got an object far away and you reach out to grab it, you can't extend further, although, you know, maybe your hand is right at the edge of the raycast boundary, so you've grabbed and now you can go a tiny little bit further. But basically, the projective space starts at where the object was and then goes back down to one with you. One way of getting around that, though, is you could grab an object far away, throw it a little bit further out, and then re-raycast, re-grab it, and now you've got a larger projective space for it. And these are all things that, you know, they come out of playing. We were in that space throwing objects in there, and then after a little while, You can pick up objects, pull them towards you, and then you're holding them in your hand. You can also grab an object with your projective hand, throw it in the air in this massive arc, then reach out with the other hand, raycast, grab it out of the air. And after a little while, it just feels like you have really long arms and that you can reach anything in the space, which I think is probably, for certain use cases, a really great way of getting objects that are beyond your reach by increasing your reach.
Absolutely.
That's so, yeah, go for it.
Summoning, cool. So that was summoning. Then the next sprint, scaffolding. So This one, yeah, as Barrett said, it came out of a little bit out of the conversations that we were having with external partners, especially in enterprise industrial, where they want to be able to, a lot of them want to be able to assemble objects in a reliable way and not worry about objects falling out of hands or collisions and things like that. And so a lot of them we'd seen, because they needed the reliability, they turned physics off. So it ended up being that, you know, they're grabbing big engine parts and they're, like Barrett was saying, because they don't have any weight to them, they're rotating very quickly and it doesn't feel like they are real objects. Uh-huh. And so they just become static meshes that you're moving around and you lose a lot of the nuance of the physicality of physics-enabled objects. So on the one hand, we have physics-enabled objects and they're really great to interact with, but sometimes chaotic. And on the other hand, you have non-physics-enabled objects that don't feel that great but are very reliable. So we wanted to create, we wanted to figure out a way that we could combine the two to keep physics on, but be able to stack and assemble objects in a reliable way. And so that was sort of how we framed the problem of that interaction sprint. So to begin with, we looked at, well, how do we do this in the real world? How do we get physics objects in the real world to reliably stack and assemble in a nice way? And scaffolding is sort of the way that we do that in construction. My background's in architecture, and so we're looking at the tools that we use to do that, especially handheld tools for measuring and aligning things. And if you look at the result of the sprint, I think it's pretty clear the measuring tape influence on the object. And you mentioned blocks. So yeah, snappable 3D grids are pretty common in most computer applications. That's not a new thing. It's very understood that that's helpful. In blocks, the way that you do it is you turn on grid mode and it makes the whole world a snappable grid. And then you can build within the units, you can change the units. That's one approach that we looked at, like global turning on a grid. But we thought, what if we, instead of doing it as a global thing, we made it tool-based and an on-demand thing so that we could create a structured volume, a scaffold where we wanted it, and then we could bring physics objects into that scaffold, and when we brought them in, they would then start aligning orthogonally and behaving in a structured way.
This is another example like the summoning use case that we picked because it was likely to be very relevant to AR. Mm-hmm. This use case seems very relevant to AR in that every app that you see in AR at this moment has to do with people putting something on a coffee table or their kitchen table or something like that. So what if you want to make that coffee table in your living room a building surface? And what if you want to just suddenly make that specific surface something that you can align things to? Having a grid that encompasses your whole entire house might not align to the coffee table. So just having something that you can just toss on the coffee table and make that surface buildable, that seems like a good AR use case.
Yeah, I think the approach that you guys are taking, being different than Google or than Blocks, has more to do, I think, with the application, where I see Blocks as like working on one specific 3D model. And with what you guys were building here, it's that you can, you need the freedom to be able to change the scale of what kind of grid you need, or even the orientation of the grids, and having different geometry pieces everywhere around your room. So yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, starting with that, actually, this also will reference back to what you were talking about with hand presence and being able to understand where your hand is in space. So what was the first iteration of this grid system? It was the colored grid?
Yeah, and the first thing we needed in this piece was really a technological piece, even to do this sprint. The first piece was building a shader that could have a notion of your hand presence. So a shader in which we could feed the positions of your hands and then do some vertex animation in the shader that would scale the dots based on your hand presence and make them glow based on your hand presence. But all of that needed to be done in a shader right from the get-go for performance reasons. That here's a case that even in prototyping, we needed to build something that could statically or dynamically batch all of those dots and do this performantly. So, but the cool thing about this is, and this is back to that hover and presence thing, as you pass your hand through these dots, this is the example I was referring to, that you really get a strong presence of where you are physically, because suddenly you have these strong perspective cues of these dots glowing like runway lights. And that's one of the proprioceptive aids that I'm talking about,
right,
where hover gets super specific.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue into the affordances in this sprint, which I think are the most important part in some ways, because like we said, 3D snappable grids, pretty common. We're not inventing something new there. But the part that is new is having a three-dimensional snappable grid that you're grabbing three-dimensional objects with using your bare hands and taking them from fully free physics simulation to constrained physics simulation. And that's, like Barrett was saying at one point when we were building this, that he's put objects, rotated objects using transform gizmos or moved them around in computer programs for a really long time. But he's never had the same feeling of grabbing an object and then having it start snapping once he puts it into a grid, which is this, it's a collision of things that we know from computer applications and things we know from the real world. And to make that feel as good as possible, what we looked at once Barrett had created the shader and the grid widget itself was, how can we make every step of this interaction feel the best it can possibly feel and give the user as much information about what they're doing so that they're successful and able to build and stack and assemble quickly. And that's how we get to, I think in the blog post, we go through very piece by piece. When you are looking to grab a block, we're showing some highlight of which block you're closest to. When you grab a block, it glows really brightly to tell you, okay, you've now engaged in grabbing this block. When you bring it into the scaffold, as soon as you bring it into the volume of the scaffold, we show a ghost of where, if you let go right now, this is where the block is going to be.
Its orientation.
And its orientation, right. I mean, that's looping around. On top of that, you've also got the shader in the grid, which is telling you where your hand is in the grid, highlighting those things. And then when you let go of the object snaps into there. So that's the grabbing and placing things. There's as many steps for once you grab a widget, where are you going to put it? How do you place it? Once it expands, if you want to move the axes and expand those things. So all of these things have lots of little pieces of affordance breadcrumb trails that we're trying to give the user that all come together to make this experience hopefully seamless.
One cool thing here in 25 years of 3D modeling, most of those 25 years, when I want to rotate something, I use my keyboard shortcut to switch to the rotate tool, and then I rotate. Then I use my keyboard shortcut and switch to the move tool and move it. This applies to controllers as well. But here in VR, I've got a 6DOF positioner that is my hand. And I'm simultaneously moving and rotating without really thinking about it too much. And it's kind of an epiphanous moment here in VR to be able to do that. I'm like, wow, I've been doing this as a Cartesian separated interaction for decades. And here I'm just placing and rotating seamlessly without a thought. It's very neat.
Yeah, it almost doesn't make sense that we've had how long we've been able to do 3D work in computers, you know, using these, every application has its own shortcuts and ways of moving around a 3D space. And somehow we're really good at it. And I think in, you know, a decade or two, we'll probably look back and be like, how the hell did people do any kind of work with that?
I mean, whenever I see Azad, editing his photogrammetry stuff in blocks on YouTube, I'm like, yeah, this is medium. How it's supposed to be. It was medium, yes. I always mix them up. When I see him doing it in medium, it is like, to me, looking into how it's supposed to be. And whenever I have to model something or edit something, or I see other people, you know, moving around things with their mouse and keyboard, I'm like, why don't you just grab it? It feels so intuitional.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is fascinating. I actually didn't realize. So you're calling the grid system itself a gizmo, because it is a kind of a block that you're throwing down and you expand it.
So we called it a widget for the actual tool. And then we're just calling the grid itself a grid or a scaffold. Another great thing that came out of it that we didn't really think about until we were using it after we built it was, imagine you're building a tower of little blocks, right? You guys have tried Blocks, our flagship yes. motion demo, right? I think everyone has at this point, which is great. If you're trying to build something up there, when you grab a block and you try to place it on the top, say you want to rotate it like 180 degrees, your wrist is going to lock because you can't rotate further than that. So what a lot of people end up doing is, you know, passing it from hand to hand, doing a half rotation and doing that, which in VR is still quite difficult to do. But what the scaffold allows you to do is you can put a block into the scaffold, let it go, rotate it once, let it go, and then rotate it again. So it acts as sort of a third hand that allows you to do things which you couldn't do otherwise, and in a way that you couldn't do in the physical world. There's no way that we don't have the ability to turn off gravity very quickly to just rotate objects.
That's something that we saw several users kind of come to on their own.
One thing that I didn't mention at the start when I was trying to explain the maintaining physicality throughout the whole interaction and not turning physics off to allow you to rotate align objects nicely. One way that we did that was when you grab an object and it's physically enabled, you bring it into the scaffold. Initially, you let go, and it's in the scaffold, and then we turned physics off. So the object was sitting in there, you could pass your hand through it, and it wouldn't be affected. But to do this maintaining physicality through the whole thing, we thought, well, what if we put a physics spring in the scaffold, so that when you put an object in there, we don't turn physics off, we just constrain it with this spring, so that when you push it around, it still reacts to you, but it will stay in place. That was a point that Barrett and I were kind of split upon. I thought that it was important to maintain the physicality, to try to keep this illusion of that this is a real object that has mass and gravity acting on it. But in some cases, it could get in the way. So you could be building something, and then when you want to put an object that's sort of like in a tough spot to get into, your hand would be knocking objects around. And so rather than just having objects remain physically collidable in the scaffold, what we ended up settling on was having objects react only to your hands, but not to each other, which is something, again, that's like really only possible in VR. But then when we get people to use it, people don't even remark on that. They don't notice really that their object they're holding doesn't interact with stuff, but they still think that the objects are physical.
Yeah, and I think in a way the springs kind of maintain that illusion of physicality throughout the life cycle of that interaction, yet they simultaneously fight against some of that precision that we're exploring.
Right.
So we ended up, like, in our example scene that we shared with people, we ended up putting a toggle in for that to let users see what they thought, and that's just a fun, fascinating thing.
Maybe a question to regard toggle. So it's something that the company I'm working with also debates a lot here internally. How much control should you give the user or the pro user over those things like toggling, snapping, toggling springs, toggling different things? Have you figured it out at some point? I guess you have tried multiple experiments and having something where participants, or actually the people trying, could toggle it. Do people use it? Do they enjoy this control over the physics of the world?
Gotten too much feedback specifically about whether, I think at this point in the industry in VR and AR, more choice is better, because I think we don't yet know what the accepted standards that everyone expects are. I think locomotion is probably a good example of that. I think we're seeing a lot of titles right now being like, okay, we're going to give you both smooth locomotion and teleportation because people don't like being forced to use one. We're definitely not anywhere near knowing what the best thing to do is, or I don't think we're really leaning towards not giving people any choice, because that would then be sort of implying that we figured out the best way of doing things. So like the spring example, I think the spring example is really good to get at an earlier point that you guys were talking about ergonomics versus productivity versus maybe immersion. I'm not sure how many axes there are to talk about this sort of thing. But on one side, the springs allow the illusion of physicality to continue throughout the whole interaction, which I think is pretty important, and which I think is one of the reasons that I enjoy building with Leap Motion, is that it feels like I'm building with real blocks and there's all this physical nuance to it. On the other side, it does make it harder to build in some cases where you're knocking blocks around and you're getting in the way of the alignment and quick building that the project was about. And those are sort of divergent. And which one is more important? I'm not sure. It depends probably a lot on the use case. If you were making this as a quick little like block building app that you wanted to make, great. If you wanted to make it as a really precise engineering thing, you probably wouldn't have the springs in there. But I think looking at all the different ways that we can do this at this stage is like the most important part.
This quickly gets to bedrock UX issues that are universal across most mediums, like how much complexity do you show the user? And you know, personally, I have a preference for give me something at the start of my lifespan with that interaction that just works and it's immediate and it's simple, and let me drill down and customize as I start to get to know the product and the interaction and allow the user to expose those things to themselves. But you know, that's almost universal UX choices versus being something that's VR or AR specific.
Yeah, I think there's some also UX in hands in VR, to me at least, that's about expressiveness. One of the things I really like about being able to use my hands as opposed to controllers is that I can have little, like my pinky might touch something or push something, and it feels like my hands in the result of that, that I'm actually there interacting with these objects as opposed to trying to interact with them through two sticks, which are my representation in the world. There's sort of this like believability that makes me more invested in the virtual environment that comes through some expressiveness, through a little bit of chaos that might go against what we would think is productivity or traditional UX, but that comes from the sort of chaoticness of having your full hands, fingers, skeleton in VR with you.
Yeah, I think people that might say that might not be factoring in the actual benefits that you'd be getting from having hands and having that expressiveness really be a big part of it. To wrap things up, I wanted to ask, have you guys seen Timony West's talk that she did at GDC, where it's actually now on YouTube as of yesterday? It's called Hardware versus Software, UX Loops 1936 to Now. The reason why I bring it up is because she takes a long time to talk about inputs and all the different categories that computers and phones fall into versus game consoles and controllers. And the things she brings up comparing a phone to a game controller is that a phone is meant to be easy to learn but impossible to master, as in you're never going to be a master at typing on a touchscreen without looking at it. Like you can really practice, but you're still going to make a good amount of errors.
Oh yes.
And we have software to account for that, right? The autocorrect, swipe, keyboards, whatever. But on a game controller, it's kind of hard to learn. Very, you know, it's not an intuitive set of controls, but once you do get over that learning hump, you can master it and you could do everything without looking at your hands. And so the reason why there's this dichotomy is because, I guess different use cases or different things that you need to do. That's kind of a big question, right? Where VR is trying to figure itself out, like, where do we fall between? Is this something that should be intuitive for anyone that comes, you know, through the door and can put it on and can do everything, same as a phone on our iPad? Or are we going down the route of this is a professional tool, or it takes a little bit of, training to get down to that muscle memory to be able to do these things. So, I guess to wrap things up, like, what are your thoughts? What are both of you guys' thoughts on the mastery versus intuitiveness when you're designing these systems?
First, huge fan of Timony, and I didn't see that last talk, but every talk of hers that I can watch, I do, and not just of her, but their entire team at Unity Labs are. Having the approach to VR UX where they're looking for the kinds of interactions that VR dictates versus trying to bring the old ones in. and they're doing that great job of finding what new interactions are happening in AR and VR. And to your point about the kind of expert versus casual user, this segues right into the interaction sprint that Martin and I are doing right now. And we took on as the design brief of this the idea of shortcuts, of what do you do when you're trying to do small, discrete interactions that are maybe productivity oriented, maybe for the expert user, and maybe meant to like forget about and do quickly. What is the VR or AR equivalent of Control C or Control V? And we are exploring this idea of VR and AR shortcuts.
Yeah, and for now, every app is different. Like Medium and Toothbrush all have different buttons for the undo and redo, and the way we bring up menus and modifier controls. All completely different between these, but I mean, it's to be expected, right? These are the early days to experiment and to try. And your guys' method is again very different than what other companies are trying to do with controllers, because it's exactly counter to how Leap wants to do things. I guess can you have a controller? I mean, is that something that you're thinking of as well, or is everything that you're trying to do completely finger based?
Yeah, so I think the Timmy's talk, which I saw slides from on Twitter but didn't get to attend and will watch today, I saw that slide. I think that was probably one of the most shared slides, was the mastery versus accessibility, or sort of that gradient. I think I've made the analogy before of optical-based hand tracking is, in my mind, in some ways very similar to sort of a touchscreen input, in that it's super accessible. And it is accessible, convenient, and therefore lends itself to these sort of, every interaction could be done in a very sort of like casual way. And then if you want to do something that's really precise and really high fidelity, you might want to get a controller with a really small tip and a trigger with some depth to it, or, you know, a bunch more inputs that would be specific for that use case. I think hands are a fundamental default input that you should always have access to, and then you can add things on top of that, like you were saying with the controller. I think there's a huge amount of exploration to be done with having a controller in one hand and having your other hand free. I don't think we've seen nearly enough experimentation on that, and I would love to get to do that soon. The touchscreen analogy of what you use your phone and your tablet for versus what you use your productivity station for, I think we're going to see that even expanded more in VR, AR. In that right now we have these separate devices for sort of different use cases, depending on their complexity and what sort of input we want. I think a lot of people are pretty masterful at using their phones at this point. Maybe they won't be able to type without looking at them, but I would maybe argue that typing isn't that great of a use case for touchscreen input. It works really well, and we've created design systems that back up when we make errors, so like autocorrect and things like that. But if you see someone scrolling through Instagram or another social media app, the full screen scroll plus the double tap plus quickly switching between apps, jumping between things, quickly texting someone back, like we've gotten pretty good at that. And I think a lot of that is to do with how minimal the set of inputs are, these full screen swipes and taps, and how physical they are, in that we're doing things with our fingers as opposed to moving a mouse to click on something that we're looking at. And I think we're only going to get more like that with hands. And that sort of leads into our next sprint, which is shortcuts. And the question is, how do you do power user keyboard type shortcuts, but without having buttons or triggers or anything that you can reliably press to then trigger those things? And so basically it's how to use motion control to quickly switch between a couple of options. And that is starting to move from where we have been with interaction engines, summoning, scaffolding, direct physical-like interaction, to something that's a little bit more towards the abstract side that requires a bit of upfront learning and a bit of tutorialization, but is still grounded in I'm using my body and moving in a way that I guess I don't want to, I can kind of give it away. Basically what we're doing is using pinch as a way of reliably triggering the menu system. So when your palm is facing up, and you do a pinch, you'll open the menu, and then by moving the pinch, translating it forward, backward, left, or right, you'll move into one of those zones to choose an option.
It's a sort of radial menu, I suppose, or a menu that it's a spatial menu that then you're moving your finger through, right?
And it pops up relative to your hand. So wherever your hand is, it's going to pop up there. So it's almost like placing a joystick on your finger and allowing you to trigger it on demand.
So the difference between like the menu systems that we've seen before for hands are that instead of being two-handed, like you've got something like the Tilt Brush, Medium, lots of other apps, you have a palette on one hand and you're using your other hand as a picker to choose something. That's still very visually based. You need to be looking at the option and then guide your other hand to that option. With this sort of like palm up, pinch, move, unpinch, I don't need to look at it because it's body relative. I can pinch and then move and let go and not have looked at the system at all because proprioceptively I know where my hand started when I pinched and I know where I let go of it when I pinched. And so it's a mixture of both body-based stuff and these sort of power user shortcuts that require a little bit of upfront learning but quickly become as natural as doing full-screen swipes and scrolls and taps on a screen.
We spent a lot more time on sound in our last couple of sprints to really add that level of affordances and explore how the sound can communicate intent and execution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think this idea of gestural-based shortcuts in VR, I'm starting to see it be a very useful trend. Especially, I think recently Tilt Brush added a gesture-based a brush picker where you can go between multi-select to erase to paint to just select by being able to kind of gesturally move it in a certain direction. So I'm glad to see that you guys are kind of aligning in that on that side as well.
This is one of our biggest takeaways is that early on in Leap's lifespan, developers would say, hey, I'm coming over from tablets and I'm coming over from touch iOS. I need the swipe from your APR. Give me swipe in VR. And this brings with it like many axes of ambiguity. Like, where am I swiping? Was that a wave? Was that a inadvertent gesture? And what we find is with these single-handed shortcuts or with any of our sliders and our buttons, if we give the user a very specific three-dimensional affordance of where to swipe, where to do the thing, and very specifically where to place hands or fingers, then we get a much more reliable result for the developer. Like those inputs can be measured much, much better. Disembodied swipe in space is so ambiguous in VR, but swipe through a volume, swipe through something that reacts to you is much more easy to track and make reliable.
Like Cosmic Trip, Hover Junkers, Tilt Brush, a bunch of them have the sort of press a button, you've summoned a menu, spatially move into one to choose an option. Even in Maya on desktop, there's like the space bar, which is like the gesture to choose the things. I think the difference for making it work with hands that we had to sort of iterate on a little bit was we don't have a button. So there's no reliable way to say like, hey, I want the menu to appear now and now I'm moving into an option. And so this palm direction plus pinching is basically when we were talking about the steps of the summoning, we're gating the thing. So if your palm, first your palm has to be facing a certain direction. Once your palm is facing that direction, you have to do the pretty deliberate action of pinching. And then once you've done that, now you're in the system. And so we've segmented, essentially use it to do this all with only motion control. We've segmented the world into, if your palm is facing you, you're in a menu system. And if your palm is facing away from you, you're in using the abilities and no longer in the menu system. So these are things that are now pretty obvious, but I think are, again, incremental things to figure out how we're going to make systems that work smoothly in the future.
Great.
So how can people find you guys if they want to reach out to you, perhaps on Twitter?
Twitter, yeah, I think Twitter is the best to reach out to both of us. I'm at MR Schubert, SCHUBERT.
And I'm at ProtoDeep, ProtoDeep. And
awesome.
We'd love to keep chatting with people about this stuff on Twitter. And we're just giffing fools right now, just giffing away and sharing there. And And that's been a great conversation ongoing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Totally worth checking out.
And for people that are listening and haven't seen the show links, the place you can find all these blog posts that they're writing about on blog.leapmotion.com. And I believe you also have a syndicated post on Road to VR and Upload VR as well. Slightly less engineering focused and more in design. So this has been an awesome episode, guys. Thank you again for joining. I think every time we talk to someone from Leap Motion, there's a lot of advancements happening on the fundamental research learnings that we need to make. I kind of would equate this to like Xerox PARC back in the 70s when, you know, they were doing all this research on mouse and keyboards and how all that works. Fascinating stuff, and like especially after you watch Timony's talk, you'll start to see the comparisons that you can make with your work now with what was happening in the 70s. So really, really important, and I'm glad honored that we get to, you know, sit here and talk to you guys and pick your brain of as to why and how you did certain things. And again, thank you all for listening. You can reach the Research VR podcast on Twitter at Research VR Cast and on Facebook at the Research VR Podcast. And you can find us on Discord if you want to have a one-to-one conversation or just talk about the episodes after the fact.
Maybe our guests can also join us at Discord.
Yeah, a lot of times they do. So Martin and Barrett, you guys are totally invited. It's a fun community. All right, y'all. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Goodbye.